Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Dr. John Andrews. John, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me back on, Nick.
Always good to have you back with us. And of course, we also have Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you doing?
Well, thanks. As you can see, I'm just trying to escape angle grinding and hammering and all those good things. So hopefully I've got as quiet a spot as I can find.
Well, I am currently not at my usual location, and I'm balancing my phone precariously on my microphone. So if my sound is a bit weird or during the recording my camera suddenly falls onto the ground, that is why. Anyway, that being said, let's get into the news of today. And it's going to be very difficult to, often I like on the show to talk about something that everyone else isn't talking about. But I think in this particular instance, there's no choice but to talk about the big news story in the world today, which is that American President Joe Biden will not be seeking re-election after pretty much looking like he was about to be declared his party's nominee in the United States. And this is not unprecedented, but I think it's never happened this late that a sitting president's decided to abandon his re-election run. Lyndon B. Johnson did this, I think, in the 70s. However, he did it after having a disappointing result in the New Hampshire primary. So Joe Biden announced that he was not going to be running for re-election in a post on X, where he said, "It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your president. And while it has been my intention to seek re-election, I believe it is in the best interest of my party and for the country for me to stand down and focus solely on fulfilling my duties as president for the remainder of the term." The president then pledged to speak to the nation later about this in more detail. Now, this is, shall we say, I think a message sent out with not a lot of happiness. Biden, it seems clear, was very determined to stay in this race and was essentially forced out in many ways by his party. The rumors behind the scenes were that essentially Joe Biden had become isolated even from many of his own aides, and was kind of bunkered up in his house in Delaware with his wife, and was very reluctant to give up the presidential race. But there was a lot of pressure behind the scenes from many senior leaders of the Democratic Party. There was pressure from Democrat voters, two-thirds of whom wanted him to drop out of the race, according to polling. And this all stems from the fact that he had that disastrous debate performance, possibly the worst debate performance that anyone has ever had in American presidential debate history, which has been going on since about the 60s. Not entirely unexpected that this happened, I think, but he did leave it rather late as some of his allies within the party were actually trying to push the nomination process forward to take place ahead of time. Now, he, upon stepping out, decided that he was going to endorse his current Vice President, Kamala Harris, and he wants her to go forward to the Democratic nomination in, I think it's in August when the Democrats have their convention. Trump has already been secured as the official nominee of the Republicans, and the Democrats will do the same thing next month. Well, this is not a done deal, however. In theory, the Democrats could select an alternative candidate to Kamala until now that these delegates who pledged themselves during the primary process to vote for Biden have been released. They are, in theory, free to vote for anyone they wish, any Democratic Party member to be their candidate. However, I think it's relatively unlikely that anyone is going to be chosen as the candidate who is not Kamala, as she received endorsements from a lot of senior leaders within the Democratic Party. Of course, she also received one from Joe Biden, so he's her kind of heir presumptive. She's already the vice president, which is a good platform for her to kind of stand on and campaign from. And a lot of her opponents, there's a lot of, I think, division between her potential rivals. You've got everyone from people like Gretchen Whitmer, who's the governor of Wisconsin, to Josh Shapiro, who's governor of Pennsylvania, to I think he's Andy Beshear from Kentucky, who are all potential candidates. And there's also more progressive candidates who might want to stand in this. And I think with all these major endorsements coming for Kamala, it's very unlikely any of them will be able to steal the nomination away from her when it comes to it. So the question is, will she be able to beat Trump? And I think if you had asked me this question a year ago, I would say that probably not. Kamala is, in my opinion, not a very talented politician. She has this awkward tic where whenever she's asked a difficult question, she sort of laughs kind of loudly, and it's just it's really bad on television. When you kind of see her like that, she sort of looks very uncomfortable. Her speeches have been quite terrible, some of them that you listen to. She often starts out with these very plodding, basic explanations of what's going on, but they're not very charismatic. She's just, I think, in many ways, not particularly well-suited. That being said, the Democrats have been panicked by what looked like an inevitable Trump victory. She's already raised more than $27 million in the first few hours of announcing her presidency, which is a third of what Biden had raised in the lead up to this period. And I think that once again, this election has now back again to a toss-up after it looked like an inevitable Trump victory with all of Biden's fumbles and, of course, the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. So, John, let me start with you. Firstly, do you agree with my assessment? And secondly, what do you make of this? I mean, this is, shall we say, an unusual American presidential election so far.
I think this is the soap opera of the world. And I think the rest of the world watches with great entertainment and intrigue at what the next development will be. And so far, I'd say this election campaign has certainly delivered the goods. There's been no shortage of scandal and sudden reversals and unexpected developments. So I'd say that we and the rest of the world have got our money's worth. What we need to keep in mind, of course, is that this is a very important nation in the world, probably the most important nation. So what happens there does affect us all in the rest of the world. And as much as we might be delighted by the shenanigans that go on in American politics, ultimately it does have an impact on us, and we do have an interest in what happens. I do think that your analysis is right. So I had the impression immediately after the presidential debate that this was the moment when it became clear that the Democrats would not be able to stick with Biden. I think he became too much of a liability in that very instant. Momentum started shifting away from the Democrats from that debate onwards. And that shift away from the Democrats was accelerated by the attempted assassination on Donald Trump. So they were really riding a wave of enthusiasm last week. It was really impressive to see. And the Democrats, I think, must have been quite concerned at what they saw going on, excitement building for a great Republican victory. And decided to pull, the plug, so to speak, on the campaign, on the Biden campaign, and say this is not going to work. We need to get him out of there. So they managed to apply sufficient pressure for Joe Biden to announce his withdrawal from the race. And I think that given the circumstances, the Democrats don't really have another option than Kamala Harris, in the sense that it is late in the day. There are lots of administrative hurdles to finding a new nominee. From who gets to pick the nominee to how the delegates vote, to what happens to the fundraising, to what gets printed on the ballots. So all of these things make it really hard at this stage to come up with a different candidate. And I think that is why Harris has effectively been the shoe-in for that role. It may still be that there's going to be some unexpected development, but at the moment, I think Harris is in a really strong position. And we are in for a wild ride because both sides are going to start slinging unbelievable amounts of mud at one another with all, no holds barred, anything goes. I'm sure that Harris is going to weaponize Trump's age against him, weaponize his misogyny, weaponize whatever they can get their hands on. And obviously the Republican side is going to do the same, and they will not treat her kindly because she's a woman. Quite the opposite. I think they will weaponize that as well against Harris. So we sit here, the southern tip of Africa, watching from a distance, and I think we are going to continue to be entertained. Nick?
Someone in the comments asked whether Hillary is coming back, and I think that there's not a single chance of that. You never know. I think a year ago I wouldn't have said that Kamala Harris would be the Democratic candidate or likely Democratic candidate, and yet here we are. I guess it's theory possible, but I really doubt that. She's already lost to Trump before, and of course she is quite controversial within the Democratic Party herself. She remains, she's also, quite old. And one of, I think, Kamala's strengths is that a lot of the election debates so far in the US has been about ages of presidents. There's a lot of undecided voters have expressed concern about both Trump and Biden's ages. So having a younger person is one of the things Kamala actually has going for her. And if they picked someone like Hillary, well, you know, that kind of reverses that entire discussion there. Even though I think she's still a little bit younger than Trump, but not by much. Sara, let me go to you. I mean, Kamala's, I think, you know, she has not impressed a lot of people very far, so far, particularly within her own party. There was a lot of worry. And in fact, Biden was kind of behind the scenes making the claims that you can't push me out because she'll have to be the nominee. I think she's likely to be the nominee. But what's interesting is if you look at the polling data, while she is unpopular, that unpopularity is not as solid as some of the unpopularity against Joe Biden. People have expressed more of an opinion, I think, more of an openness to change their mind when it comes to her. She hasn't been as, you know, people generally tend to not pay that much attention to vice presidents anyway, so they don't have as strong opinions on them. But, you know, what do you think she has to do? I mean, it seems like there's very little room for error if she wants to kind of revive Democrat fortunes here. What do you think she has to do if she wants to kind of have a bit of a comeback here?
Well, I think it would help if she didn't carry on appearing on sort of daytime television programs hosted by gushing female celebrities and actually, you know, adopted a more rational, serious look about her, because that's been her problem. I mean, we know that vice presidents aren't in the best position to carve anything out for themselves, but she managed to really not carve anything out for herself except this the sense of resorting to the strangest homilies when interviewed. So, you know, we were sort of told by an American who sort of knows the scene that she was a reasonably good senator, and that he's quite surprised that she, her stint as VP was really in some respects risible. Now's the time for her to show it. And of course she has the advantage of being, of filling all those spots of DEI, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusivity that Joe Biden hired her for in the first place, despite her doing very badly in the presidential debates, you know, when she stood for nomination pre the Biden success of the last presidential election. But you know, that's certainly going to, that should be good news to the left wing of the Democratic Party. Interesting, what I have noticed is that Obama hasn't yet come out in support, and somebody mentioned Michael, assuming Michelle Obama, transgender, I don't think has hit that level yet. But I think the problem would be for her that while she's blacker than Kamala Harris is, you know, to go up against the VP, the woman who's hung in there, who ticks almost all those boxes, it's probably tricky at this stage for all the reasons that John has mentioned. And if Kamala has something we haven't seen, then now's the time to bring it forward, because she does have age, sex, color in her favor, and that'll appeal to a large number of the Democratic base, presumably. But I think it's, you know, for me, it's too difficult to tell at this stage. It depends, I think, to a lot who makes the first real misstep in that sort of tussle between her and Trump in the hustings, in the being nasty and aggressive towards each other. So I don't know. I think what swings in America wouldn't necessarily appeal to the rest of us, but who knows? I'm not a fan of her. I think she doesn't represent, she hasn't as yet in the last 4 years represented women particularly attractively, certainly not unless you're on the far left perhaps, but you know, age and demographics may.
I think she has a bit of an opportunity here to kind of reinvent herself slightly. And that's because, you know, as you said, you know, when she was a senator in California, she was certainly kind of left, as one would expect as from a senator of California these days. But she was also, she did have this sort of slight law and order streak to her. In fact, her kind of progressive detractors used that against her. The familiar phrase on social media was, Kamala is a cop. But that's actually probably the image she would want to lean into if she wanted to try and win some of those Midwestern voters. And I think she does have the problem in that she has that disastrous campaign in late 2019, 2020, as most people's perception of her, where she tried to run quite far to the left, where she tried to basically, kind of, but I guess, I don't know how else to describe it, but sort of just kind of run a almost generic, what we might call woke campaign within the Democratic Party, which was not successful. She did poorly in debates. It was just not a great campaign. And that's many people in the political world's perception of her, which is exactly why she needs to run very far away from that. And I think if she does pick a moderate swing state Democrat as her vice president, assuming she, of course, gets the nomination, she will be able to start kind of building up that image. And I think she also benefits from the fact that, this is going to be a sprint. Americans take forever to have their elections and they build up their campaigns very slowly. And she's going to have to do it all in 3 months. And that is actually, I think, an advantage for her, because I think she would annoy a lot of people if she stayed on their screens too much for the entire 12-month period. But I think if she has a good campaign, makes good strategic decisions, she could actually kind of turn around her party's fortunes. But she needs to start on it now. So her very first strategic move of leaking that VP list, I think, was a very clever one. But she's going to have to follow it up with a lot more clever ones if she wants to actually rebuild her reputation before the election, because I think she really isn't in a great spot at the moment. John, do you have anything to add?
I think that, so I have a bit of the impression that the Trump campaign benefits from sort of this rah-rah enthusiasm, which I think may be the factor that allows him to win the race. So hard to make a call at this stage, but at this stage I'd say my money is on Trump. There was a recent promotional video, I don't know if it was put out by his campaign or somebody else. Lots of militarism, lots of rock and roll, lots of, power, might, dancing, sex appeal on screen. I think that sort of thing is going to sell. That's the sort of vibe that people are going to like. And I'm not sure that Kamala Harris will pull that off or want to lean into that.
I think like we said, we actually don't know what kind of campaign she's going to run, because, she hasn't had this long wind up and she's sort of just been thrust into the limelight so far. So, yeah, a lot to play for in U.S. Politics right now. And it's certainly going to make for interesting watching, even if, watching the chaos. And I hope that this is the most exciting thing that happens for the rest of the election. I hope that no one else tries anything funny, shooting or people dropping out or anything like that. It would be nice if this was just we had a nice, calm, normal election going forward, because when the Americans have a fit, the rest of us usually get caught in the crossfire. I'd rather hope that this is as exciting as it gets, because I'm not sure if I can, if me or the world can survive too much more excitement from the Americans in the next couple of months. Anyway, let's go on to our next story. And this is about, once again, returning to South Africa, the expropriation without compensation debate has reared its hideous, ugly head. The EFF, the MK party, have both called for digging up the amendment to the Constitution to basically make it fully appropriate to not have any compensation for expropriated property. And this seems to have also been echoed by the Minister of Land Reform from the PAC, who is within the Government of National Unity. The DA has attacked these moves, saying that they do not support the PAC's efforts to reopen the changing of the Constitution debate and the expropriation of property debate. Fikile Mbalula from the ANC was asked about this debate, and he seemed to give a little bit of an uncomfortable answer. The ANC is clearly still not entirely sure where it sits on this debate, because, of course, it failed to change the Constitution after not being able to agree with the EFF, and instead pushed through the expropriation bill, which kind of tries to do the same thing, but it doesn't have the sort of the strength of having the Constitution changed, and that's going to, I think, see it challenged in court. But anyway, Fikile Mbalula, when asked about this, said, we wait for what is before the president to be accomplished, meaning the expropriation bill. The land reform program must not stop, it must proceed. We may well arrive at that decision at a later stage, but at the present moment, we have made significant progress in terms of what is before the president's desk, and we must give the president a chance to process that, and from there we move forward, and so on. So there's a little bit of kind of discomfort and vagueness. The ANC normally would like to sort of go rah-rah all forward with expropriation of compensation, but I think there is what I'm detecting a little bit of reluctance here to kind of charge forward with that one, particularly when they haven't gotten the expropriation bill signed yet. John, let me start again with you. What do you make of this? It looks a little bit like the ANC really doesn't want to get sucked into this fight again when it's just going to cause problems for its allies and for its partners in the GNU and yet.
Yeah, I think it's much of what we expected, I think, when we saw this GNU being put together, when one of the questions was how they're going to deal with the really contentious conflicts or areas of division between the DA and the ANC, especially like EWC and BEE and the NHI. And our suggestion was what they would do is kind of freeze it and say, well, I just keep the status quo as it is, not move ahead further, not move backwards, which would allow both the ANC and the DA to save face. And this is an example of that in my view. So you say, look, you know, the expropriation bill has been prepared. It's awaiting the president's signature. That's the status quo. We keep that. And expropriation without compensation being introduced by changing the constitution, that's a separate process. We're not going to go there now. That's not the right time for it. I think in terms of the NHI, we might see something similar. So the president's opening of parliament address mentions the NHI once in a way that seems that they do want to push ahead, where they say, look, you know, there's disagreements on it, but we will talk to each other and we'll resolve those. And then there was another statement that suggested that maybe they wouldn't push it as far ahead as maybe the health minister would like, for one, where they say, we've recognized that to provide quality healthcare to South Africans, we need both the public and the private sector. And so if you introduce NHI, then basically the private sector is toast. If you want to preserve the private sector, then you've got to water down the NHI somehow. And so hopefully we'll see quite a bit of that. I think it's a good sign, willingness to compromise on the part of the ANC and the DA, and hopefully also a movement towards presenting a united front on the part of the ANC and the DA towards the more radical elements, such as the PAC land minister, and also the EFF and MK, of course. Thank you.
So sorry, I thought it was quite interesting that even though, you know, the ANC is not entirely ruling this out, and even though the call was in many ways launched by the sort of so-called progressive caucus, the self-described progressive caucus, that the DA's response to this issue was initially to go after the PAC in particular, who is actually in government with them, and say, you know, we're against this, we're supporting this. And that seems to me to be a fairly diplomatic move to oppose this, but without directly going head to head with the ANC.
No, I think it is clever. I assume that PAC minister was appointed as a SOP to the left, to the Progressive Caucus or whatever they call themselves, and one couldn't one sort of expected this thing to happen. I think the advantage that the ANC has is that it's effectively moved beyond the fact that the original vote to change the constitution failed. They didn't get the necessary 66%. And the EFF opposed it because it didn't want mere expropriation. It wanted full custodianship. That were the grounds. And in the meantime, the expropriation bill exists. It's been passed by the National Assembly. So to an extent, I think the DA has played it very cleverly in the sense that it allows the ANC to kind of say, well, we've actually gone beyond that. And how it plays it with regard to when it gets signed into law is another thing altogether. But the progressive opposition is not in a position to make any changes. They can just shout a lot and probably use a lot of racist invective. But the DA, I agree, I think it played it very cleverly because there was that sort of emotional controlled outrage against the forces of evil left and keeping the lesser evil forces of the ANC satisfied because they didn't attack the ANC. And I think that sort of holding position and having the majority in the assembly was a clever way to handle what would be an obvious plus for the progressive forces to really lose their minds over.
So I think there's an interesting another change in the reality of this sort of thing, which is that if you add the ANC, EFF and MK parties together, they actually, if they all decided to go back to, you know, trying to change the constitution, they fall short of that 2/3 majority in parliament. Now, maybe they could cobble together, I don't know, the UDM as well, and Al-Jamaa, and maybe they would be able to reach the 2/3 thing. But I think that it's clear that this is not a genuine effort, I think, to change the constitution now, because it's so sort of politically difficult, but rather a deliberate tactic by the EFF and MK to split the ANC away from the DA. John, do you have any final thing to add on this topic?
A very quick one, Nick. Just the idea that in the opening of Parliament address, the President did put economic growth quite far up the agenda. And I think a really important point to make here is, like, expropriation without compensation does not move you any closer to getting economic growth. It moves you further away, as one of the commentators
said. He didn't talk anything about this, actually, in his speech. He only mentioned giving away state land. Which is very different to expropriating private land.
Land reform and state land, yes, but no EWC. So, yeah, I think this is sort of kind of a positive development, even though the expropriation bill is still concerning. But, yeah, it's sort of a sign of moderation.
All right. Last story, very quickly. There's been a lot of concern over the past couple of years when it comes to university students being able to fund themselves. This was, of course, crystallized in the sort of Fees Must Fall movement. And one of the things that policymakers have kind of zoomed in on is this group called the Missing Middle. Students who basically aren't wealthy enough to actually aren't wealthy enough to afford university fees, but at the same time are not poor enough to qualify for assistance. And through the NASFIS loan scheme. And there's now been a sort of growth to the scandal that it has emerged that 580 million rand was returned by the Department of Higher Education to Treasury, sort of a surplus amount that had not been spent. Now, normally that would be a, you know, pretty good thing, except for the fact that potentially one could expect students to have been paid. And there's been a lot of problems with paying students from the NASFIS fund recently. So, John, you again, this kind of raises some questions about how exactly is the Department of Higher Education spending its money, and, you know, why do they have the surplus, and, you know, how should we actually solve this problem of lots of people wanting to go to university but not being able to afford it?
Yeah. So what stood out to me in that story was that, like, the event that triggers the discussion is that money is being returned from a government department that didn't spend all the money, and so it has to return a surplus to the National Treasury. But the interesting thing is the response to that. And this article you shared that we've been reading starts out by mentioning the missing middle, which is one interest group, one group of people that would have liked that money. But as you go through that article, you get lots and lots of other groups. So it'll say, maybe that money should have been used for the community education and training colleges, because, you know, those are really important. And then you read on and it says, well, maybe, you know, lots of universities actually need to be upgraded. Like, the infrastructure is not so good and they haven't got enough money. Maybe it should be used for that. And then you see somebody else saying, oh, but what about the National Research Foundation? Like, research needs more funding. And this so perfectly illustrates this idea that, you know, state funding is like just, it's this huge pot of money that's available and that just gets splashed across everything. And even though it's so much money, it's still not enough and it's never enough. And I think the conclusion from reading this story is actually to say, guys, actually, it is time to cut state spending. Like, this is crazy. You're never going to have enough money for everything. You do have to prioritize. You have to pick your battles. You need to focus on a priority, which now, according to the opening of Parliament address, is economic growth. Focus on that and put the money to whatever produces economic growth. And recognize that you're not going to make everyone happy. Not everybody who shouts for money and wants to get some money from the state is going to get it. And in this case, you know, just as well, they're underspent, well done. It's good for the fiscus. Maybe it's good for, you know, maybe it gets put towards debt repayments, whatever the case may be. But it's actually a situation in South Africa, I think, where spending needs to be cut. Not all of it is being fruitfully spent at the moment. Nick.
So, Sarah, one of the things that always strikes me about the university debate is the reason that people are so desperate to go to university is because, firstly, there's so few jobs. So people know they need any, you know, advantage they can possibly get. The unemployment rate for university graduates is, I think, something like 8 or 9%, which is way, way below what it is for the general population, you know, sort of 40%+. And I also think people want to go to university because their high school education is so bad. And so, you know, people think, well, I need something extra because high school doesn't actually get you anything. Because, you know, if you get through high school with your national senior certificate and it's like a lower than a degree pass or maybe even just a straightforward, you know, sort of 30% in four subjects pass, that's not going to really set you up well for any kind of job. So I think fixing some of the problems with basic education would actually do a lot to alleviate the demands and unemployment in general on the university system, which really can't accommodate, you know, everyone. What do you make of this?
Well, I think John's observations about the interest group, the various other interest groups that expressed interest in the use of the money, actually reflects a generally common sense view that the ANC made the mistake of ignoring or avoiding or simply going against at the beginning of its term, and that it highlighted the esteem value of going to university. So it put a lot of emphasis at the top instead of at the bottom. So it went with the universities, but it went with matriculating, when in fact the problem actually had to start at the bottom and work through the system, not start at the top and try and work backwards to primary schooling and before. And it's a sort of probably unintended recognition of the fact that university graduating is an elite benefit. I mean, we need skills, but we need a hell of a lot of skills in a hell of a lot of areas. And particularly, we need to take away from that the sort of mystique of your tertiary education being an intellectual result rather than becoming an artisan of some kind or being able to offer skills that are immediately valuable, and the fact that universities are not producing enough where skills are needed, for example, in computerization and everything related to the fourth industrial revolution, and never mind the fifth, which we seem to have not got on the train for at all, it obviously being a shortage of trains. But I think that's the problem, is that people realize that essentially what they're saying is this is a reflection of pragmatism benefiting the wider group of potential kids or potential young adults who could benefit. And in many respects, university education is actually not that. It doesn't provide that.
Another point I just want to quickly make is that, you know, our unemployment rate for graduates is sort of 8-9%. The US, by contrast, their unemployment rate for recent graduates, which you would expect that to be even higher, is actually like between 3-4% over the last 10 years, with the exception of during COVID when it shot up and came back down again. So I think that also actually brings into perspective how bad our unemployment situation is, that even our most skilled, most educated members of the population are still experiencing unemployment rates at twice that of more developed countries. John, any final thoughts?
Maybe just to... So my comment earlier might have created the impression that I don't think education is important or spending money on education is important. I think it's very important, but it's also important to just keep in mind the competing demands on any public money. And I think that's where the prioritization is important.
No, exactly. I mean, I actually think that education can sometimes be a little bit overrated in terms of the sort of short-term benefits it gives to your society. You know, if we educated everyone at university in the whole country, but we still had the same unemployment rate, Life would not be that much better for a lot of people. And we wouldn't be able to magically just bring our unemployment rate down, because the things that are causing our unemployment are not just lack of skills, but actually much deeper structural problems with incentives in the country. Okay. With that, let's call it to a close. Thank you very much for watching. We hope that you all have a wonderful day, and we will be back with the Daily Friend Wrap tomorrow. Cheers, everyone. Have a good day.